Hello, friends, and welcome back to the show. Before we dive into the conversation, I want to take a moment to tell you all about Shady Rays. Before I say anything else, let me say this. What I'm about to lay out is not a paid ad. For the longest time, I kept seeing these ads on social media for these sunglasses, polarized, just the right fit, and they looked cool as hell. Well, then I checked out their website and I ordered two pairs. I have got to tell you, these are the best sunglasses I've ever owned. Shady Rays is an independent sunglass company that focuses on one thing, making the best shades for living active and worry-free in the outdoors. These shades feature shatter-resistant, high-visibility, polarized lenses, and durable construction. And the Shady Rays team stands behind them with free replacements if you lose or break them and a lifetime craftsmanship warranty. I can testify to this. If you break a pair of glasses or you simply lose them like I do, just reach out. All you have to do is pay for shipping. They send you another pair. Unbelievable. And here's what's really cool, friends. They didn't want to settle for being a company that just sells sunglasses. They wanted to make a difference with each purchase. Through research and talking directly to their fans, the Shady Rays team found the cause that gives purpose to their work. In partnership with Feeding America, Shady Rays donates 10 meals to fight hunger in America with every single order. One pair of sunglasses equals 10 meals. Thanks to their loyal customers, Shady Rays has provided over 9.4 million meals, and they continue to donate thousands of meals every day through Feeding America-sponsored food banks across the country. Folks, everyone needs a good pair of sunglasses. Stop paying hundreds for them and go to this website right now. Go to ShadyRays.com and check out their fantastic sunglasses. I promise you, you won't be disappointed. ShadyRays.com, make that purchase, give your eyes a much-needed break this summer, and help feed America 10 meals at a time. And we're back, Mr. Lindsey Graham, executive producer and creator of like 100 podcasts. We'll touch on them all today, I promise. This is a conversation I've been excited about having for a long, long time. Thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
So I have so many questions. I think the best way to sort of kick this conversation off today is for me to ask you to tell our listeners about some of the shows you've had a hand in over the years.
Well, okay. Let's see if we can do it chronologically.
Sure. So
the very first podcast... Well, okay. The very, very first podcast was a local music podcast in 2005 called Deconstruction. Mm. You won't be able to find it. It's gone. And for good reason. It was just two guys blathering.
Yeah.
But the first real podcast in the modern sense was an audio drama called Terms in 2016. That was a fictional tale of political intrigue that turned inadvertently was a little less fictional than intended.
Yeah.
That podcast caught the attention of Wondery, and they distributed it and put it out. Back then, Wondery was much more interested in audio drama than they have been for a while, mainly because they've lost their enthusiasm for audio drama because it just wasn't selling in the market, and they are a business, of course.
Yeah.
Through my introduction to Wondery, Hernan Lopez, the CEO there, approached me after Terms to voice the ads for a show, Dirty John.
Hmm.
He just liked the way I had read ads in Terms. And because the host of Dirty John was a journalist and obligated not to endorse products, they needed to find someone else to write and read the ads. So he called me up. I said yes. In the same phone call, he said, "Hey, we've got this idea for a history podcast that we've had some success with another one called Tides of History. We want to do one more American history focused. You're a history buff, right?" And I said, "Of course, yes." "And how would you like to host and do the sound design for this show called American History Tellers?"
Yeah.
So we just hashed that out for a while, a couple of months, and he asked me, "What should we start with?" And I thought the Cold War sounded pretty good because this was 2017. And if you recall, we were kind of rattling the sabers with North Korea over nuclear weapons and Russia was looming. It just seemed a very Cold War moment.
Yeah.
And then History Tellers took off. We hit number one on iTunes the week we debuted. Everyone was over the moon and a bit surprised. So I thought to myself, I was at the time working at a university in marketing, and it was rough putting out a weekly show and working full time.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, you know, if I had two shows, that would allow me both the freedom and the security to go full time podcasting.
Right.
So I cast around. I looked at the marketplace of podcasts, and true crime seemed to be, and still is, an enormous force in podcasting. I was like, you know, I don't really want to do that, but I get why it's popular. So what if we do another history show, but we kind of skew towards true crime?
Yeah.
And so I came up with the idea of American Scandal.
Yeah.
And brought it to Wondery and said, hey, I've got this idea for a new podcast. I had a few other ideas, but this was the big idea. I'll sell it to you for a ridiculous amount of money and a handshake in exchange for pretty much the same deal you offered me on History Tellers.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, they liked the idea. We developed it over a course of a couple of months, and it debuted in, you know, the summer of 2018, I think.
Yeah.
And it did really well. It did not reach number one, mainly because this day after it debuted, Serial season 3 came out. So we got kind of lost in the wake of that.
Yeah.
But it is now the biggest show that I do. And so I was able to convince my wife that, yes, this is actually a career that I can pursue. And I quit the job at the university and became a full-time podcaster.
Wow.
And of course, since then, I've hired a sound designer, a full-time employee, and that gave me more time to start thinking of new projects, one of which was 1865. That was brought to me by a friend of mine, Stephen Walters, who had heard Terms and had this idea, had a stage play and was pitching this series as a TV show unsuccessfully around L.A., so he thought, why not make it a podcast? And it fit in my wheelhouse really well. It's a history show. It's a political thriller. It's, you know, it's everything that I've done previously, but yeah, probably more so. We put that together over the course of about, I don't know, 18 months, 2 years,
yeah,
off and on. And it came out in November of 2018. And then that was on Stitcher Premium. It made its public debut in June of 2019. A few short months after that, we debuted American Election's Wicked Game, which will run for 58 weeks, recounting every single presidential election in history and ending with our current one on November 3rd, 2020.
That's awesome. That's great timing, too. I love the concept of that show, too. There's really a lot to chew on there, a lot to get to. Obviously, you know, your shows are very steeped in history. I'm a history freak. It's right up my alley. So what I wanted to ask you, though, is what do you think it is about using history as a subject and podcasting as the platform to sort of bring it alive again for so many people that maybe didn't see how fascinating and drama filled really our history is?
Yeah, you know, I was lucky in that I had a few very good history teachers in high school and college who understood that history is narrative and used that drama to excite us as students in understanding and learning.
Yeah.
Most people, whenever I've encountered them and they told me, oh, history, I hated history or I hate history. It's because they approached it as a series of facts, as a science, and not as this rich human dramatic tapestry that it is. Of course, there are important themes, and you have to understand why a certain event is consequential or who the people were. For me, history is not a string of events on a timeline. It's a huge ocean of events of every single person that's ever lived passing into the next moment.
Yeah.
And that includes births and deaths and loves and, you know, falling outs, friendships and enemies, of course, as well as all the wars and battles and dates and documents. I asked David McCullough why he was so interested in history, why he made it his career, and
yeah,
long and distinguished one, in an interview. And he boiled it down. History is human.
Mm.
That's the start and end of it. If you understand that these people were striving just like you are, that they were hurting just like you are, that they that that every single moment, whether it's the Trinity test or the Triangle Fire, they had impacts across not just the people involved, but you know, the entire nation.
Yeah.
And you would these people would do as you do. They would pick up a newspaper and read about something and think about it, and it might affect their life or it might not, but it affects the world. And so I think that narrative and that humanity is why history is compelling when it's told well.
You know, take me through the creative process when it comes to executive producing a show or performing hosting duties or even creating something from scratch. I mean, what is the amount of involvement that you have to give to these shows for different hats that you're wearing?
Well, you've described at least three different hats, and they're all very different. So the two Wondery original shows, American History Tellers and American Scandal, they are produced by Wondery, and I, you know, work on a contract basis for Wondery to get these shows out, which means that I'm not responsible for a lot of the stuff. You know, I don't write the shows, I don't research the shows, I don't produce the shows in so much as finding the writers and researchers. Wondery has been doing that. Once we found, and after the first two seasons of each show, where we found the footing and understood what the show was, my involvement decreased.
Yeah.
Who knows when I'll be able to get back, but I tried to fly out to LA twice a year to get in the same room with the Wondery people to talk through the schedule for the next 6 months and be a real participant. And I enjoy those moments. You know, we spend hours talking through things, and of course, we're in contact every week. But at this point, it's a well-oiled machine. We know for a few, we've got a big list of topics. We don't really know exactly what's coming up too far in the future, because that's mainly scheduling issues. Can we find a writer for this slot?
Right.
And many of these writers haven't written for audio before, so there's a learning curve. And so at this point, for those shows, I'll receive a script oftentimes just a week before we air. And so I'll have to review it and record it and then edit it and then sound design it and then ship it back to Wondery for review and revisions. And then hopefully all that gets done in five workdays. thankfully, I've got a very capable sound designer in Derek Behrens who helps out a great deal. He's now doing all the sound design for all the shows, which wasn't the case in the early days.
That's a great segue into sound design, because you did the music and sound design for 1865. I gotta tell you, I can't overstate this enough. That's the best sound design and score I've ever heard on a show, like hands down. It really is. When you're scoring a show or when you're creating sound design, what's that process like? You know, for all the folks listening that either are podcasters, want to be podcasters, want to do what you do, can you give out a few tips and tricks? Because getting sound design right is tough.
Yeah, sure. So let's talk about the score in particular. This might be a little niche. But really, I was just terrified for a few weeks trying to come up with, you know, trying to find the thing.
Yeah.
I had some influences. I had some ideas. I knew I wanted it to be a modern sounding score with synthesizers.
Yeah.
But I didn't want it to be like Stranger Things or anything.
Right.
And I wanted it to nod to what we feel and expect for a Civil War show. So the violin was an obvious choice, but I didn't want it to be Ken Burns violins, right?
Yeah.
Finally, I came up with the theme and just playing around on my guitar. It has some interesting things to it. It's in both major and minor at the same time. And I thought that was appropriate. So once you know, I had an idea, then I cast around and fiddled with it for a long time and invited a friend of mine, Becky Howard, to come in and play the violin. Pretty soon I had a lot of bits and pieces, and it all came from the theme. Mm. So once I knew what that sounded like, then I could kind of extrapolate from that sound what the rest of the soundtrack's going to sound like. Now, I've done had done the soundtrack for Terms. I've done the soundtrack, you know, for History Tellers, for Scandal. I've composed all that music, and it's given me a process. And it's a process that that is built around efficiency.
Yeah.
The entire score is in the same tempo and in the same key. If I need variations in feel, then I don't have those tools available to me. I have to go somewhere else, like Dynamics or just arrangement. What that does, though, is make it very, very easy to edit on a grid and layer different cues together because they're in the same key, often the same chord changes.
Yeah.
So it becomes this this collage work of existing pieces. And so I knowing that I would do this, I sat down with a palette of instruments that I'd already discovered through my wrenching work trying to figure out what the theme was. And then I wrote, you know, 30-second cues.
Yeah.
They're just, sometimes oftentimes they're the same chorded progression. Many times they're just drones without any chords at all, but they're different textures and different things. And so I came out of it with 50, you know, different pieces of music that could be assembled like Lego. And so that's how that show was put together. That's how all the shows are put together at this point. It's efficiency minded, but still with an ear towards making it effective emotionally. That's obviously the objective.
Yeah, it does when it works. I mean, you nailed it right away for sure. Because I mean, the musical build, you know, especially in the dramatic scenes when you're hearing, you know, Stanton talk and all these different things, it you have this crescendo. It just kind of builds and builds and builds, and then that violin hits and it kind of transitions from scene to scene, and that is it's really, really powerful. So, I mean, kudos to you and what you did. I mean, music to me is a huge deal when it comes to not only to film, but just anything. Podcasting obviously is a big one. So, I mean, yeah, hitting that out of the park, I think, was crucial. And that was very, very well done. I mean, I can't overstate that enough.
Well, thank you again. It was a lot of fun to do.
Absolutely. Now, I know we touched on a Wicked Game. We're going to kind of bounce around a little bit here, but how much research goes into telling the story of every election? I mean, that's got to be a very, very, you know, huge process to go over the detail of every election like that, especially the elections that people don't really remember.
Right. And, you know, we're right in the Gilded Age, the end of the 19th century. And that's a doldrums of American politics. Where candidates were nearly indistinguishable. While I was working with Steve Walters, the writer and co-creator of 1865, it occurred to me that, hey, he's pretty good. And
he is.
And he has many of the same, he's a history buff as well, and comes from the same place and has a complementary skill set. So I approached him to be my head of content for Wicked Game. So he had already had a lot of experience researching and writing dramatically for 1865. I also introduced him to Wondery. He wrote some shows for American History Tellers and American Scandal. He came, you know, without knowing it, I groomed him pretty much to become the head writer for a Wicked Game. And so in talking with him, he dove right in. He just grabbed a bunch of books. There are several that are surveys of American elections.
Yeah.
To give you some, you know, some, at least set you down the right path.
Right.
And then you go through the bibliography and find additional sources. There's, you know, the internet is amazing in its ability to open up obscure research for you.
Oh, yeah.
But pretty soon, you know, once you've got the facts at your fingertips, that's not enough, though. Steven's real brilliance and why this show might be good is that it finds the characters and the narrative moments that are important, both historically, but to the humans involved.
Yeah.
What is the theme of each election? It's not just the campaign. There's something else in America and in Americans in this moment. And so we want to draw that out and identify it. I would say that's the hardest thing to do.
Yeah.
You're looking at a 4-year period of American history to try and cram into 40 minutes and make it cogent and make it, find the heart of it.
Yeah.
That's what's difficult. And, so when I get a script back from Steve or others, that's what I'm looking for. And it's sometimes it's harder than others.
Yeah,
we've had shows that, there have been critiques like you didn't focus on the election at all. And I can't remember which election it is, but that's right. we didn't, because the election was boring and it didn't itself address the heart of the issue that America was facing in those 4 years. So we pivoted, but we do try to focus as much as we can on the horse race, the election.
You know, just kind of going over the shows you've done and listening to them and kind of researching for this, you know, talking to you, getting ready to talk to you, I found that Terms is a lot of show that a lot of people refer to sort of as the West Wing of podcasts. I'm sure you've heard that, like in feedback and stuff. People really kind of compare the two. The idea of a president-elect and kind of everything surrounding that election, the good and the bad, creating audio drama, that's got to be difficult, but it's also got to be fun, right? I mean, is it different than just doing a narrative as opposed to creating an audio drama with a cast and everybody you have to kind of wrangle and you know, create parts for and go through that whole process?
Oh, it's fantastically different. You're right. It's a lot more fun.
yeah.
You know, it's more creative. There's a much broader palette available to you. But that broad palette comes with expense and time and effort. These audio dramas are difficult to make, expensive to make, and hard to sell. So if there's a reason there's not a season two of Terms, it's all of those things. It just wasn't commercially successful. And so you have to leave your babies behind to move on to the next better, more verdant field.
Right.
But audio drama is fantastic. It's the most fun I've had in any sort of project. And it's the best of podcasting for me anyways.
Yeah.
It's a team effort. Everyone brings their strengths to the fore. It is hard to do, but very worthwhile. And for a producer like me, you just get the satisfaction so many times of seeing people nail it. You know, just a great script or a great performance or you know, I wear a lot of hats, so I'll pat myself on the back, like, a great sound design.
Sure.
There's so many moments in an audio drama that is like, that was fantastic. And you get them over and over again. So it's really rewarding.
For American history tellers, is there something like very just beneficial to you personally to cover major historical instances from such like an intimate perspective? I mean, that's one of the things I really got from listening to several episodes of that show. Is like there's a level of intimacy, like all your shows really, but there's a level of intimacy with that one that you just sort of feel, you feel like you're talking about the little things that sort of add up to a bigger thing and maybe covering sort of parts of stories that people have never heard before. Is that something that, was consciously like a decision from the get-go when you're kind of creating that show? And
that was what we arrived at pretty quickly. When we were trying to figure out what this show was.
Yeah.
All of these shows, these narrative shows, have these reenacted moments. And that's the strength and weakness of the show. Many people find them off-putting until they listen to enough of them and figure them out. But the History Tellers in particular has a style that was deliberate from the onset, that it focuses on the everyman and it has a second person viewpoint. We call at least one character in all these reenactments you, with the real intent of trying to evoke empathy for this person who is not a president or a senator, oftentimes, but you know, some yeoman, a blacksmith, a soldier, who is just as ordinary as you are, who is just in the midst or adjacent to this magnificent moment in history and is affected by it. It was absolutely deliberate and it's there to connect with the listener as well as we can.
And then, you know, talking about a little bit about American Scandal, I mean, American Scandal doesn't really paint a very positive picture of some of the nation's darkest days. I mean, you do dive into some really interesting topics and some real tough topics to kind of cover. But in listening to that show, I asked myself, is it ever difficult to cover some of these cases and look at some of that tough material? Does that ever weigh on you? Like, God, this is a really dark period. This is like really something that I can't believe, you know, this happened, or, you know, this is kind of something that's really tough for me to cover?
The answer is absolutely yes. There have been some seasons and some portions of these shows that I don't like. I find them repulsive. And I mean, honestly, the entire Mysterious Mr. Epstein was difficult for me.
Yeah.
I don't mind telling the story. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's a story that should be told and understood. It's a, you know, if only to stop anything from like it from happening again.
Right.
But as a father to a young daughter, you don't want to be wallowing in this stuff. You don't want to think about how best to convey in your vocal timbre how horrible this is, or to try and hide how horrible it is because you're talking through the POV of a monster. You have to make conscious decisions in your narration that require you to think like a pedophile.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I guess it's not too far away from acting. It's not fun. It takes a toll. I'm glad the shows are out there, but yeah, sometimes they're not fun.
Yeah, you can definitely feel it through your voice, and yeah, the content is sometimes dark, but it, like you said, it needs to be talked about. All right, so this is going to bring us to this is a show that, I mean, 1865. I don't even know where to start. I just feel like this show is such a great. This should be required listening for high school and for college history. I really believe it should be. I've talked with you a little bit offline. We're sort of neck deep in the Booth case right now for season two of Vanished. So, I started listening to the show when it first came out. I couldn't wait for each episode to drop. I was all in. Talk about, I know you touched on the show a little bit, but give us like an overview of 1865. If people have never heard of the show, what's it about? What does it cover essentially?
Most people, remember that Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. But if you ask them what happened the next day, very few people will know. They'll remember the Emancipation Proclamation, the end of the Civil War, Appomattox, you know, some stuff, and then bang, Lincoln is dead.
Yeah.
But what happened after is almost, if not more important than the entire Lincoln administrations. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is the country was suddenly unmoored. And a compromise candidate from a different party became the head of the country with different prerogatives and a different direction.
Yeah.
And at a crucial moment, just weeks after not even the complete surrender of the South to the North.
Yeah.
So 1865 is therefore the story of what happened after and why it's important and why our nation took what could have taken 10 years and stretched it out to 100.
Yeah.
There's a man, a Secretary of War called Edwin Stanton. He, in this moment of rudderless leadership, stepped into the vacuum and tried to keep Lincoln's agenda moving forward in the face of fierce political opposition and chaos, really.
Yeah.
So he was a very strong character with strong convictions and was not afraid to justify the means for the end. 1865 therefore follows him in his attempt to stop President Johnson from wreaking havoc, to keep the promises that Lincoln made to the slaves in the South and across the nation, and rebuild the nation in a progressive, fair manner. He was only halfway successful.
And this is the show that was created. You mentioned Stephen Walters earlier, Eric Archilla. Stephen Walters co-created the show. I'm looking forward to speaking with them during the season two of Vanished. But those guys must have done, and I listened to the bonus episodes where you sit down and you interview them. The amount of research for this show, for this season, to go as deep as it did, that must have been just an almost insurmountable amount of research they would have had to have done for this.
Yeah, well, they've had 14 years to put it together.
Yeah.
It's very well researched. I think one of the best things about it is how much real documents are interwoven into the show, not only just in the Telegram sections, but you know, where possible, they used actual dialogue lifted out of journals and recollections. It is really factually based. We do stretch things and make suppositions to fill in some blanks and increase the drama or make or just put the narrative together. But this is pretty much what happened. And it's we can point to, you know, we could footnote this if we needed to.
Yeah. Yeah. And like terms, you've got a full cast of some of, the absolute best voiceover work I've ever heard, not just in a podcast, but ever in gaming and just a lot of the different, you know, platforms that are out there. But first, let's talk about gathering that cast as like an executive producer. Take us through that process. Like, are there auditions for that or roles created with specific actors in mind? Like, can you give us a little bit on that?
Let's talk about terms first. That was such a new project with no prior experience. We just turned to our friends. That now, thankfully, our friends are in the Dallas theater, you know, community. So they are actors by profession. We kind of knew, you know, like let's cast Lydia for this and or Jeff for that, and so there wasn't too much casting by audition. Now, right. 1865 was different, mainly because the entire cast is largely old white men, right? So we needed to find differentiated voices and who could fill these historical characters.
Yeah.
These characters could have been molded by the actor a little more than maybe 1865 because they're historical and they have some very particular requirements for the role. So we did audition for 1865. It was almost all local, with the exception of a few notable names. Reed Birney and William Jackson Harper, who we got through favors. The biggest role, of course, is for Edmund Stanton, and we had cast someone and brought the actor in to start recording. We went through the first day of recording, and I had to pull Steve aside and just admit that I don't think that's the voice.
Yeah,
it wasn't landing right for me. Mm-hmm. And Steve was disappointed because he was eager to move forward. I think it was even a friend of his that was cast. But we had to, you know, take a step back and reassess and the decision was made. Yeah, no, this isn't the right voice. Let's keep auditioning. Mm-hmm. And we reached out to Jeremy Schwartz, which we were reluctant to do. We knew he existed here in Dallas, but he was a union actor. Which meant as soon as we hired him, we would have to go through all sorts of different other layers of production and bureaucracy and costs too. But we managed to figure out the arcane and very convoluted union system and get through that because really Jeremy was the once we heard him. He was the only choice.
Yeah, let's get to that. You touched earlier about producing a show and getting to hear standout performances, and when someone really nails a performance, there's so many standout performances in this particular show. And I've said this on social media. I stand behind this. If there were an Academy Awards for podcasting, hands down, Jeremy Schwartz will win Best Actor for his performance as Edwin Stanton.
Oh, I don't disagree.
Yeah, that role, I mean, that decision you made and that kind of that hunch you had, I think, was the right one. That performance gives you chills at certain points throughout the show. Can you talk a little bit more from your perspective about hearing Jeremy's voice, the performance he gives? I mean, this is really exquisite work.
Well, Edwin Stanton on the page, I mean, even from the very first scene in which we meet him, he is barking, commanding. He understands the situation much better than anyone else. He fills the room, and you need a voice that can do that. I mean, just the tone, the timbre of the voice. You need some gruffness. You need some gravel. You need a lion.
Yeah.
That's how we meet him. He's screaming orders, but just two scenes later, he's sitting next to a dying President Lincoln, his friend and president, and he has to be tender and heartbroken. And Jeremy did that with just exquisite skill. And he had a range. And also, I got to tell you, Jeremy is just whether he's a savant or not, he has an intuition for these things that is very fast. Most of this stuff, even though is pretty much cold reading. No one's committed. No one's off book. They haven't memorized these lines, so they're reading off iPads, maybe for the first time or the second time. We don't do many takes either. Probably about four on average.
Yeah.
And Jeremy just knows where to go. That's his gift, and so he gave it to us.
Absolutely, and another standout. I won't go through them all, but Montgomery Sutton is John Wilkes Booth. I'm particular interest in that character, of course, right now. Just his voice makes you as a listener feel like you know what Booth would sound like. Like if we could hear the real Booth speak, he'd sound like Monty Plaisom, I think. I mean, how important was it for you guys to get Booth right? He's not a huge character in the show, but especially with the prequel episodes, which we'll get to in a second. But he's in there and he's like this everlasting presence, this kind of aura around the show and all these characters. But what was it like to kind of work with Monty Sutton for Booth?
Well, Monty was kind of pre-cast as Booth because he had played Booth in the stage version of 1865. Well, for years before that.
Yeah.
And he is an actor who often appears in Shakespearean productions. Monty is. So it kind of makes sense that his theatricality, it would be embodied in a character like Booth. So he has experience playing Booth. He has experience being a Shakespearean actor. this is an easy win for all of us. And and I think also, Monty just has a certain amount of madness in his in his voice, especially when in the times when it's required. That was compelling. That was convincing.
Yeah, absolutely. 100% agreed. And speaking of Booth, and I just touched on it now, but you got to put out some prequel episodes after season one finished. And I tell everyone that I recommend the show to listen to the prequels first so you can sort of understand what drove Booth to do what he did. Not excusing it, but the writing and the acting is so well done that you can sort of feel the turn from one position to another. He's a sympathizer. He plays the man who pulls the trigger. Was that an intentional creative design to try to show how a famous actor at the time could ultimately assassinate perhaps our most beloved president, to show that process?
Well, that's the intent of those three episodes. It's an arc of radicalization. But you have to understand that we were sitting on this material. It was a stage play about Booth originally, and it kind of morphed into a stage play about Stanton, and then became a podcast, and then definitely became a stage play about Stanton later. So there was, we just have this material, this entire play about Booth. There was some question like, what do we do with it? The great thing about podcasting is there are no rules at all. There's no norms. So why not go ahead and produce them? We have all the, it's not too much more work to put together three more episodes. And there's some discussion is like, do we make it a real, the first three episodes, or do we interweave it, throughout the series? I think we made the right decision. I'm interested to learn that you recommend that people listen to it first, because our team decided, no, we should have a retrospective, a flipping of the mirror and go through the same timeline, but from the other side. So that's how we decided. And it's because the material is there, the interest is there, and in podcasting, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah, and I think it gives you a really good perspective of a full picture snapshot, essentially, of kind of, because you guys cover so well the aftermath and the fallout of Lincoln's assassination and everything that politically was going on and what Stanton was dealing with and trying to hold the country together and hold Lincoln's ideology together. But hearing everybody just know sort of, well, Booth was the guy who shot Lincoln, right? But nobody really knows. A lot of people don't really know how he came to be that guy and what kind of what switch was flipped essentially to make him kind of make that decision. And I think listening to those prequels and then the whole season of 1865, I think is the way to go personally for me. I mean, everybody will think differently, but I think that's the right way. So like we talked a lot about music, sound design tonight. What I wanted to ask you the last question about that is just, it's so good, obviously, in the show. How important is it for those three aspects, music, acting, voice acting, sound design, to come together essentially when it comes to an audio drama like this? I mean, that's gotta be the bread and butter, right?
Yeah, I would say, obviously. I've thought a lot about what for me makes a successful audio drama. There are quite a few out there that, and many are very successful, but that I don't enjoy. So I have to confront the fact that this is popular, this has, you know, sustaining longevity, but I just don't like it.
Yeah.
So why is that? It could be that it's just subject matter. It's like, okay, I'm over zombies, for instance. But in the largest part, it's the acting. There's a certain lack of, well, I can feel the acting when I listen to it. And then I had to kind of try to dissect that even further. Why is it that you feel the acting? I'm not saying this is a bad choice, because clearly many of these shows are very successful and people love them dearly. I think they've made a choice to go ahead and act and emote. Like,
yeah,
this is a, I have feelings. and that's a very direct way of communicating. But for me, I don't like that. I want it in the opposite direction. When we get actors into the studio, we immediately tell them, you know, this is not a stage play. This is not even voiceover. This is a movie, and it's the microphone is your camera, and it will do all the work. You barely have to act.
Yeah.
You barely have to emote. We are constantly asking people to pull back, because I think it's part of the authenticity of it. So that's what attracted me. I don't know. I mean, it was an impulse that I first had in Terms. It carries through 1865. I will continue to search for authentic sounding human interactions more than any characterized acting.
Yeah.
If you like 1865, or if you like this feeling that was real, then this is how you achieve it. Pull back.
Yeah, good point. What's been the best and the worst part of podcasting in your eyes, just over your careers thus far? Can you pinpoint one great thing, one not so great thing?
Well, I guess the not so great thing right now is that, you know, it is my job, right? there was a moment in which it was something fun to play with, and now it's my 9-to-5, and I go in and I get it done, and there are some moments in which you're just like, oh crap, I got to read 12 ads today.
Yeah.
So okay, there you go, working.
Yeah.
When podcasts become work, that's, they're not fun. But I got to tell you, the best thing is podcasts are fun.
Mm-hmm.
It is satisfying to do the work that I do on Scandal and History Tellers and Wicked Game, where I am literally teaching America about itself. It is fun to do when I pick up a guitar or a keyboard. It is fun to do, to act through these scenes as I do and these reenactments. It is really fun to hear mixes back from you know, my sound designer Derek, and realize that he's doing a great job and getting better.
Yeah.
So I've got a job. My job is podcasting. That requires some elements that are just job stuff. But it's a really good job.
Agreed, 100%. Okay, before we get out of here today, I want to do something fun with you that we do with everybody that sits on the show now. I'm sure you're familiar with the show Inside the Actor's Studio, James Lipton.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so he passed away not too long ago, and so you know, that was one of my favorite shows. My favorite part of every show was the questionnaire that he did at the end with everybody that sat on the stage with him. And so we're actually incorporating that sort of as a tribute to him, but just to kind of keep that whole spirit going. So I'd like to do that with you if you're open for it.
Sure, why not? I should have these probably pre-written. They're, you know.
Yeah. Well, they're not too bad. They're pretty fun to answer. So this was a questionnaire that was actually created it was made famous by Bernard Pivot on his show Apostrophes. And so 10 questions, and we'll just kind of fire them through and we'll go from there. So the first one is a great one. What is your favorite word?
This is cheesy, but but it's when my daughter says dada.
Oh, I love that. That's great. Yeah, that's a great pick. What about the opposite of that? What's your least favorite word?
Probably any time when a teacher or a parent said Lindsay.
That's great. Did that happen a lot?
Well, I was often enough for me to remember.
Yeah. I like it. Okay. So what turns you on? Good conversation, big brains, you know, what history? I mean, what's the one thing that turns you on?
This is probably why I like my job so much.
Yeah.
back in my 20s, I was a little lost, and I took one of those questionnaires or a survey to try and tell you what career you should be in.
Yeah.
It came back and it told me that I should be an architect, which kind of sucked because architecture requires like 10 years of schooling before you can design a bathroom.
Right.
So I was like, okay, I'm not going to do that. But that's what I like to do. I like designing and building things. And this is why I have four or five shows instead of one. This is why I have many projects instead of a few. I love designing and building things. And I realized this, I'm not a sculptor. I'm not designing and building things to be looked at. Yeah. I'm an architect. I'm designing and building things for people to live in. And I think that metaphor is probably not a metaphor. It's really my drive.
Good. Yeah, that's a good one. What about the opposite? What turns you off?
Boredom. I can't stand to be bored by myself or other people.
Spoken like a true creator, for sure. What sound or noise do you love?
I probably love unexpected moments in music. So weird shifts in tonality or strange but working chord progressions. There's nothing better than when a song goes slightly left or right and I'm caught delighted and unexpected.
That's a good one. What about the opposite? What sound or noise do you hate?
Here's an answer. The stuff I can't hear. So I'm 46 now, but my hearing's actually not that great.
Yeah.
So my high end has been lost. Anything above 10 or 12 kilohertz, I just can't hear.
Yeah.
And I'm that's not true, but I'm still 20 decibels down, which is pretty bad. I wish I had that back. I hate it that I can't hear that stuff.
Yeah.
I did a little experiment, and I was listening back to some music I did, and I decided to boost the high end where I can't hear it to back to where to compensate to what a normal person would be hearing, and I literally almost cried because it was I heard everything so richly, and I was like, that's interesting. At first, it was very bright, but my brain and ears, you know, acclimated quickly, and then I turned it off.
Yeah.
And I realized how dull and lacking in sparkle it was, and that was a very depressing moment. So I hate that I can't hear that.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way with sight actually right now. So I can understand your position there. Okay, number seven's everybody's favorite one. I won't hold it against you if you don't want to answer it. But what's your favorite curse word?
I don't know that I have a favorite, but I mean, there's the two that I use probably most are probably fuck and Christ. And they have different, it's like one is like indignation and surprise, Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And one is anger or, you know, disgruntlement, fuck. So you know that there's the my two go-to.
Those are two good ones. Those are two really good ones. Okay, what profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Architecture.
There you go.
Yeah, we've already discussed this.
Yeah, that's an easy one. Yeah.
No, but that's actually not true. I would probably go back to the reason I have so many microphones and instruments around me is I would love to be a record producer. You know, that would be it.
That's a great one. What about the opposite? What profession would you not like to attempt?
Door-to-door salesperson.
That's a good one.
Anything that requires extreme extroversion and being inured to failure.
Yeah.
So hats off to all the salespeople out there. Man, I appreciate you.
Yeah, that's a tough job. Okay, the very last one, perhaps the most poignant one. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Surprising, isn't it? what would I like him to say?
Yeah.
Probably everyone's here.
Yeah.
I would hate to find out that heaven existed and that anyone wasn't given the chance to be there.
Simple but profound. Okay. Plug some shows for us. Tell everybody where they can find 1865, where they can find Terms, where they can find all the shows that we've talked about tonight. Plug your social media, all that jazz, please.
Sure. The easiest way to do it is open up Google and type in 1865 podcast. you'll find it. Or American History Tellers Podcast, or American Scandal Podcast, or American Elections Wicked Game Podcast. Google any of those with the name of the show plus the word podcast, you'll find it. The same thing for whatever app you use for your podcasts. Hit the search button and just type in the name of the show. If you want, you can follow me on social media. I'm semi-active on Twitter. Lindsay A. Graham, that's L-I-N-D-S-A-Y, and then A in, for my middle initial, Graham, that somehow differentiates me from the senator. And then Wicked Game Pod is on Twitter, and 1865 Podcast and AH Tellers. Those are all available on Twitter as well. And there are some Facebook groups, but honestly, Facebook isn't really hopping.
We will, and we will have links to everything we touched on, all the shows throughout your career so far, in the show notes tonight for tonight's episode. Lindsay, it's, like I said, it's one of the conversations. It really has been a conversation I wanted to have since I first heard 1865, and definitely since I've, started catching up on all your shows. This has been a genuine, genuine honor. So thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you.
Oh, thank you. I had a great time talking.
If you made it all the way through our conversation tonight, I want to thank you for hanging out with me and my friends. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media as we post each new conversation as they air, news, show information, and much more. Go to facebook.com/meandmyfriendspod. On Twitter, you can search the handle meMyFriendsPod. And on Instagram, you can find us by searching the handle @meandmyfriendspod. If you enjoyed our conversation tonight, please do me a favor and head to iTunes to rate us and leave us a review. As a brand new podcast, we need all the help we can get, and your time is truly appreciated. Me and My Friends is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by me, Chris Williamson. This episode of the podcast featured the original track Reminisce by producer Rediman. The opinions on Me and My Friends are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. Any audio clips used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of education and entertainment, and no infringement is ever intended. Me and My Friends is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Me and My Friends is a Chris Evan Films production, copyright 2020, all rights reserved.